Hello and welcome to Cobden Centre Radio with me, Andy Duncan. Tonight we're joined by one of our principal Cobden Centre founders, Steve Baker, who's the Member of Parliament for Wickham in Buckinghamshire, who was elected in this year's general election. Now, before reinventing himself as an MP, Steve served as an RAF engineering officer, becoming a chartered aerospace engineer along the way. He later worked as a consultant software architect in a variety of industries, including the banking sector. And on his website, he says this work in the banking sector helped inform his present work on reforming the financial system. So, good evening, Steve.
Good evening, Andy.
Okay. Now, I'd like to know more about you, particularly your background in Austrian economics. So, can you tell me how you got interested in Austrian economics and how did this take you down into the path of politics?
Well, the first thing to say is really it was two parallel paths. It wasn't exactly Austrian economics which led me into politics, but let me start at the beginning. I joined the Royal Air Force when the Cold War was on. And then, of course, we thought we'd won the Cold War. I'm still trying to figure out if we did win the Cold War, but that's a subject for later. The dot-com boom happened, and I was in the Royal Air Force. It was a desk job. Engineers spend a lot of time on staff work. So I thought, you know, I could do with getting into business. It looks like fun. Off we go. So I went to read an MSc in computer science at Oxford. And while I was there in 2000, of course, you know, the dot-com bust happened. And this was a bit aggravating. You know, I'd invested my own personal time and money into a master's degree to get into the industry. And then there was the bust. And a friend said to me one day, hey, have you seen this thing, the Austrian business cycle theory? And so I read into the theory and understood how the artificial manipulation of interest rates misleads entrepreneurs, causes excess credit creation, and really drives the business cycle. But I parked it. I got involved with a good software company, and I've had a good 10-year entrepreneurial career in software. And I parked it. I thought, well, if there was anything in it, then surely the economists would know. So, you know, maybe it's wrong, whatever. I got on with my software career. I then found myself at Lehman Brothers. And at Lehman Brothers, you know what happened. I was there in the boom years. Everything was go. Suddenly, all at once, the whole financial sector collapses. And I knew what had happened. It was clear to me that what had happened was, again, excess credit creation. So, hence the Cobden Centre. I approached Toby Baxendale and Anthony Evans, and we kicked off the Cobden Centre. Parallel to all of this, it was about 2007 when I realised something was wrong with democracy, and it was the Lisbon Treaty, and really that was what drove me into politics. That was the final straw. There's a huge range of things I care about which go into producing a good society, and one of those things is you must be able to dismiss your government at the ballot box. And that was the final straw for me, finding that we were being given the European Commission with no ability to dismiss it. But very much in parallel with that, the Austrian economics, because actually what we find is the mass misdirection of resources, the business cycle, unemployment, you trace it back through Austrian economics and you get a clear and consistent explanation for what's happening in the world.
I just find it amazing with the Lisbon Treaty. They signed it in private, didn't they? Was it Gordon Brown who signed it in a back room without any cameras?
Well, I think there were some cameras, but it wasn't a proud moment for him or for the country.
Okay. Now, you've been involved a lot with Douglas Carswell, and we'll be speaking about him later. But I was just wondering if there's anyone else in Parliament, apart from Douglas, who's what I'll call on the side of the angels?
Well, there certainly are some guys on the sides and girls on the sides of the angels. I think we all like to believe, particularly those of us new into politics, we like to believe that all politicians are lazy good-for-nothings. But I'm delighted to say it's not true. I won't name too many. Certainly, I wouldn't like to imply that anybody necessarily endorsed Cobden Centre views on money. But I would really watch Jesse Norman. Okay. Jesse wrote a book called Compassionate Economics, which is a fabulous read. Very thoughtful, very insightful, and certainly watch Jesse. There are other MPs who've expressed an interest in the kind of economics we discuss, but I wouldn't want to name them.
Right. You said that you wanted to get into helping sort out the government, but even for many, many years, the government has been growing and growing and growing. Even with Margaret Thatcher, who many on the kind of right consider a darling, the state grew, and this has been going on for 100 years now, since I think the Crimean War was the big uplift when they reintroduced the income tax. Then we have the First World War, then we have the Second World War, and through each of these wars the state gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And even now we read in the papers about government cutbacks and everything. But if you look at, say, something like samizdata.net, you'll see Perry de Haviland is talking about actually the government spending is going up, even though they say it's being cut. Do you think that this growth of the state can be reversed by people like you, Jesse Norman, Douglas Carswell? Can we actually start reducing the state, or is it a kind of whistling in the wind exercise?
Well, it's the million-dollar question, but it just must be done. If we just rewind a moment, certainly John Redwood spotted during the emergency budget debate that total spending would continue to increase. But as a constituency MP, looking out for my constituents, there is no doubt that these reduced increases in spending are going to cause a lot of pain and heartache and worry. So talking about the cuts, it's difficult because there's just no doubt that people will suffer from reduced increases. But it is so you know, you don't want to be frightening people by painting a picture of suddenly a much smaller state. That is not what's going to happen this year. But you're quite right. There's a wonderful chart produced by the Institute of Economic Affairs, which shows the state growing from 10 to 15% of GDP before the First World War. Two big spikes for the First and Second World War at 40 and 70% of the economy. And then up through 50% with Mrs. Thatcher, back down a little bit as a proportion of GDP, and then now back up through 52%. And what people forget is that in the satellite countries of the Soviet Union, the state was about 60% of GDP when the Soviet Union fell. So that's comparable with Northern England, with Newcastle and so on. And Northern Ireland, I understand, is about 70%. So the long and the short of it is, when you look at our debt projections from the Bank for International Settlements, you look at the total scale of our debt today, including pension liabilities, there is no doubt that the kind of economy we have today will not continue. It's not about choice. It won't continue. Sooner or later, we will find that our debt interest payments are such a large fraction of the overall economy, that it will cause a catastrophe, and I don't doubt that. It wouldn't be moral to inflate away people's pensions, despite the fact I hear people on the left talking about it as if, you know, we've done it before, let's do it again. But that is part of the problem. There's this assumption that what you do is get into debt and then inflate it away, but it's immoral, it distorts the economy, it won't work forever. Pensions are index-linked. Some bonds are index-linked. You know, the situation we're in will not go on forever. Whether we can rebalance our economy gracefully really is the million-dollar question.
I mean, watching the Greek riots earlier in the year, everyone's sitting in England thinking, well, how can they carry on like this? Where do the Greek people think the money's coming from to keep paying them all of their welfare payments? But we're starting to see the same sort of thing here. Do you think that the government, this current government, this coalition government, will have the nerve and the ability to stand up to this propaganda campaign by the public sector unions particularly, if genuine spending cuts will start biting in as they say they're going to? Do you think they'll be able to take the heat? Will they be able to keep going with it, or will they just do what everyone predicts they're going to do in the Austrian world, which is just print more money to get out of it?
I believe that this government has the sense not to try and print money to get out of it. I know that many Austrians see it that way, but when you look at what George Osborne has said about having an economy based on save and invest, when you look at his attitude to the economy and being responsible, I actually think that we've got a good chance, you know, of a good stab at saving the economy within the current monetarist Keynesian blend that is contemporary economics. But for me, if we're truly to turn the country around, and in the end it is all about the lives of ordinary people just trying to get by, bring up the kids, have a job, if we're going to turn around the country for their benefit, we do actually have to inject some Austrianism into the contemporary mainstream, and that for me is our best chance of really making a difference and pulling things round.
Which I think brings us rather neatly onto the Douglas Carswell bill. Steve, can you tell us all about it?
All about it? Well, it's exciting days. Douglas took me by surprise by... he's a fantastic parliamentarian, so he knew how to get a 10-minute rule bill. He's bowled in, picked up a 10-minute rule bill, introduced it. We collaborated on the content of his speech. Obviously, I wrote in the Wall Street Journal in support on Conservative Home. It's the most controversial of subjects, fractional reserve banking. And in introducing the bill and in writing about it, we have to really strip the debate of all nuance. And I support the stance we've taken, but I know it upsets some people in the Austrian world, some people who support fractional reserve banking. But something to remember is we've got such a bad banking system at the moment. It's the question is, where do you start? And there's no doubt that fractional reserve banking is part of the problem within the framework of the banking system we currently have. It's true that it obfuscates property rights. It's true that people are not absolutely clear what they're getting into. But there's loads of other issues. Deposit insurance, central planning of the interest rates, the fact that what we use as a medium of exchange is bank credit. The most marketable commodity today is bank credit, and there's effectively no restriction on producing it at the banks. All of these problems, but to get them into one 10-minute rule bill, it's difficult. So I'm hoping on the second reading that I'll have a chance to add to Douglas's remarks and try and broaden the debate a little more, try to talk more about the denationalisation of money and what Hayek had to say about reserve ratios in that context, talk a bit about Anthony Evans' proposals, Kevin Dowd's, and try and just broaden the debate a little. But in the end, I'm of the school that follows Huerta de Soto. And I personally think fractional reserves are a problem, but I appreciate the nuance in the debate and the breadth of views. But it's certainly been very, very exciting to work with Douglas, who's a brilliant parliamentarian, a great visionary, and he just seized the moment and ran with it. And it's great fun. It means we've got a second reading this year, and I hope by Christmas the result of Douglas's bill will be that we've really broadened the debate on money and banking, just as the government's commission is really getting into gear.
Yeah, I mean, you can see people are all at sea with finance. Nobody really understands what's going on. So I think you've both got a great chance of getting the ball and running with it. And I was just wondering, what do you think the chances of success are with this second reading? Will it go further and will it actually become law, do you think?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I mean, the reality with private members' bills is they're introduced really on the nod. However they come in, they are introduced at first reading on the nod. They get a second reading on a Friday, which is conventionally when MPs are doing their constituency business. So there'll be very, very few MPs in Parliament. So usually, obviously I'm a new MP, but my understanding is that actually usually they stop at their second reading. If sufficient MPs are inspired enough to give up their Friday in the constituency and support the bill, then it could go through. It's not impossible. But the reality is with private members' bills, without government support, particularly one of this magnitude, changing the banking system, it is not likely to go through. But what it will do, it gives us both an opportunity to speak in the House of Commons on exactly this problem, what is wrong with the banking system, and what practical actions can we take next. So it's about broadening the debate, widening the conversation, bringing more people into knowledge of the sheer range of things wrong with banking today. Just tweaking up the capital adequacy rules by a few percent, not really very effective, like pushing on a piece of string. So I'm very proud and happy to support Douglas and just to try and widen that debate.
That's great. I mean, you can see these things with Rob Paul in the US with auditing the Fed and auditing the gold reserve and things. He kind of knows they're not going to go through, but just him pushing them brings things out into the open.
Well, this is it, you see. I listened to Vince Cable the other day, and he knows there's something wrong with capitalism. But what's wrong with capitalism is that all exchange is facilitated by money. And the system of money and banking has really deep-rooted fundamental flaws. And actually what's wrong with capitalism is that the banking system is socialist. You know, it's centrally planned, it's legally privileged, bailed out at taxpayer expense. It's not capitalism. And this, I think, is where things are so valuable, because if we have a bad double dip and people are asking, is this a failure of the state or a failure of markets? Well, for you and I, it's a very, very clear answer. It's an absolutely clear case of state failure, of intervention gone wrong. And we must get that message out to people so that if they're given a choice between voting for more of the state or more freedom, they vote for more freedom, because that is the solution.
This bill, this Carswell bill, it seems to be a very clever jigsaw piece to me, and there seems to be a bigger jigsaw behind it. Is there a bigger jigsaw behind it? Are you being kind of led by an intellectual such as Kevin Down or Anthony Evans or Huerto de Soto behind the scenes who's putting these things in for you? Or is this just coming from Douglas Carswell, coming from you directly?
Well, there's no conspiracy. I mean, to listen to you, you'd almost think there was a conspiracy, and there isn't, of course. The Cobden Centre is what's behind what we're doing. This particular bill, the brains behind it is Toby Baxendale, who's a great man. He had the original vision of the Cobden Centre. And, you know, Toby is in the tradition of Huerta de Soto. And it's really Toby and some of our international colleagues who put together Douglas's bill, obviously working with Douglas, and I had sight of it beforehand. So where this bill fits in is a programme of reform that follows Huerta de Soto's five-stage plan that he set out in Money, Bank, Credit and Economic Cycles. And it's worth saying that that bill, it's in the tradition of the 1844 Bank Charter Act. It's not like it's unprecedented. And I've listened to mainstream economists say no one saw the crisis coming. No one saw it. No one knew this would happen. It drives me crazy. Huerta de Soto in 1998 set out what would happen, set out the mechanism. And it's unfortunate, perhaps he was writing in Spanish, but it's not like he's the first author in the tradition. And these are the guys we need to be listening to, the people who saw it coming and knew why it had happened and are setting out these carefully considered plans. What can we practically do next? How do we work towards a system of banking which is not riven with statism? And so, yeah, the answer is Huerta de Soto's plan, as interpreted by Toby Baxendale, is behind this particular bill. But the Cobden Centre is about more than Huerta de Soto. It's about a platform. It's about showing that the debate does have breadth and depth. It's not about silver bullets. You know, Kevin Dowd, brilliant book, Alchemists of Loss, different reform plan. And as you know, there's 10 reform plans up on the Cobden Centre site. Even that is not complete. So, yeah, we're being completely open at the Cobden Centre. Anyone can log on. Anyone can participate in the debate. That's what we're looking for, just to try and widen that conversation and really bring out some of the problems which are at the heart of the crisis.
Okay. This crisis, just want to finish with a couple of things here. Where do you think the British economy is going? I'm fairly convinced that the American economy is in serious trouble. Do you think we're going to be sucked into their trouble, or do you think we can avoid circling the drain and we can lift ourselves up and get out of this over the next couple of years?
It would be wonderful to be able to say something really positive and uplifting. The most positive thing to say is, thank God we've got a Conservative and Liberal Democrat, as it happens, but coalition government of this shade that is Liberal, that is Conservative, which is free market, at least in inclination. Had Labour led a coalition or won outright, I would really be deeply concerned. As a follower of the Austrian school, I look at QE coming in to follow hard on the heels of so much credit expansion in excess of real savings. And there just has to be a double dip. The distortions that both QE and credit expansion will have introduced into the economy, and we can see them, banking, house prices, related industries, government, all funded by this massive currency debasement. The idea that this won't lead to a double dip, it's almost silly once you're aware of books like Prices and Production, you know, Garrison's Time and Money. These books set out the realities of the economy, which make it crystal clear that you cannot stimulate economies successfully by just injecting new funds. So just to finish the point, I mean, it's almost tragic the level that current mainstream economics has reached. The economists are so obsessed by coarse aggregates that they're trampling over the reality of human existence that is the economy.
Do you think we have a problem with a double dip coming? If Vince Cable thinks there's something wrong with capitalism, it's actually crony capitalism. And if we do hit a double dip, then those kind of the Miliband brothers will be straight in there blaming capitalism for all of the double dip problems. And won't that give us a really big challenge to overcome that attack on capitalism?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I was out last week at a meeting talking about cuts, and it was a small meeting, but there were three guys there at least who were proper old-fashioned state socialists, one in particular open Marxist. How anybody's got the courage to declare that they're a Marxist after all that happened in Marx's name, I don't know. But nevertheless, open Marxists with a story which is convincing for those people who are confused about why it is that they, on low incomes, have had to bail out the banks. Why is it that prices rise, particularly in housing, and exclude them from the market? People who don't see any prospect of things improving for them. And the socialists, the state socialists, do have a convincing argument. Now, we know that the state socialists, the Marxists, they are thoroughly wrong. They're dangerously wrong. But we face a problem, and that's that too few people alive today have lived through a time of proper totalitarianism. Now, as I said earlier, I left the Air Force because I thought we'd won the Cold War, and we understood that state control was not a success. But if you look back at the writing of Hayek in particular, now Hayek was a socialist. People forget this. Hayek was a socialist, or at least socialist inclined, until Mises showed him that it could never work. And actually, even Hayek, who the socialists detest, was interested in what was a good and progressive society based on social cooperation and genuine community, freely chosen relationships. And we have to get the message out there that actually, if you care about society, if you care about generating prosperity, you have to oppose the state, because it is the state interfering with human cooperative relationships which has caused this crisis. It's the state which has caused the distortion in the economy, which is impoverishing the poor. It's the state that forced everybody to bail out wealthy people. You know, we could go on and on. We really have to get to a point where we've convinced people, and I include the professional economists, we've comprehensively convinced them that the central planning of interest rates and the legal privileges granted to banks are counterproductive, and actually that they endanger a free society.
Do you think we... Right, I'm going to ask you a big question here. Do you think we can overcome this momentum, this Keynesian economics momentum? Do you think it's possible for us to get a decent, honest, free monetary system in 10 years, 15 years, 25 years?
If I didn't think it was possible, I wouldn't waste my time sticking my neck out like this to advocate fundamental bank reform against the grain of the majority of economists. I think it is possible for people to understand what has happened. If you explain to somebody, you know what, you could go out tomorrow and have a massive spending boom on your credit card, and then afterwards you'd be find yourself paying it off for months, and you know what, that wouldn't be a sustainable, prosperous lifestyle. People do understand then that what the Bank of England did, and the other central banks, was mislead everyone with low interest rates. You know, people can get this. It is common sense. And I think what the Austrian school has, which is an advantage over any empirical school which uses coarse aggregates and mechanistic connections between those aggregates, the advantage we have is that we are closer to the truth than the alternatives. And in the end, common sense and something that's closer to the truth ought to win. It ought to be possible for us to persuade the majority of people that central bank intervention and legal privilege caused this crisis.
I've heard that there's a Channel 4 documentary coming out, Steve, is that right?
There is one, yes. WAG TV are producing a documentary, which I understand is coming out on Channel 4 on the 21st of October. So I think the day after the comprehensive spending review is announced. And they've interviewed a number of the chancellors who are still around. And they interviewed me, I think some of the other new boys as well. I understand that my footage was quite good, but I haven't seen it. It's a high-risk endeavour. But I tried to explain some of the things that had happened to the economy in that film. So I hope people will watch on the 21st of October, Channel 4, time to be announced. But that should be a useful contribution.
Okay, I shall set my Sky TV player up immediately.
Marvellous.
Okay, thank you very much, and good night, Steve.
Good night.